My name is David Cobb. I like to say that I am a proud, I am a patriotic, and these days I am a ticked-off American citizen. Oh, good. Good. I'm so very pleased to get that kind of reaction from this crowd, because I'll tell you another thing, folks. I will also proudly identify as a political progressive. And as a political progressive, I think that we have made a mistake by allowing the Tea Party to claim some sort of monopoly on political anger. Because, folks, if you will engage a Tea Party adherent or a Tea Party supporter, if you'll just talk to them, one human being to another, and I've done this, what I've found almost always is what they're angry about is the fact that Wall Street America destroyed the economy, but really what gets their goat is that the federal government gave them $1 trillion in response. Well, you know what? I'm angry about that too, aren't you? Right? And let's be clear, I don't want the Tea Party to be the only place where that kind of political anger is expressed. And I'll go a little bit further, because I'm also angry about the fact that 1 in 6 families are living below the poverty level in the United States. And I rarely hear that anger expressed at Tea Party rallies. I'm angry about the fact that approximately 20% of the children are going to bed hungry in the United States of America. And I don't hear that anger expressed at Tea Party rallies. And I'm angry about the fact that the economic institutions are destroying the planet that we depend upon for life itself, causing a global runaway climate crisis. And I certainly don't hear that anger expressed at Tea Party rallies. And since I'm getting such a good response, let's just go ahead and be clear. I'm also angry that the United States of America is a fundamentally racist, sexist, and class-oppressive society, and I damn sure don't hear that anger expressed at Tea Party rallies. Right? So, I am angry, but I want to be clear. The anger I'm expressing right now that so many of you clearly share with me, our collective anger is a righteous anger. And I use that word very carefully, folks. It truly is righteous because, you see, righteous anger is unique. Righteous anger requires action. That's actually how you can tell it's righteous. Because, frankly, if you just get angry about something and stew and wallow in it and just, like, get your anger and turn it on yourself, that's not righteous by definition. In fact, that's actually dangerous. It's dangerous emotionally, it's dangerous physically, it's dangerous spiritually and psychologically. That's not righteous anger. Righteous anger requires us to act. And get this, in my lived experience, by allowing myself to experience the righteous anger at unjust conditions, unfairness, to allow myself to own that anger and then let it provoke me into righteous action for peace or justice to create the world I want, I've discovered joy. My anger transforms into joy simply by the act of acting. As George Friday says, what you gonna do? Right? Analysis is all fine and good. What you gonna do? Whenever you begin to act for justice, and in fact, that's how you can tell it's righteous anger. And may I suggest to you that it was righteous anger that provoked the abolitionist movement in this country. People were angry about an unjust, depraved institution like slavery. It was righteous anger that brought those women together at Seneca Falls to stand up against the patriarchy they were experiencing on the day-to-day level. It was righteous anger that fueled the civil rights movement. Righteous anger fueled the trade union movement. Righteous anger is a good thing, and we ought to own that. Yeah. And I will tell you that I'm also a proud and patriotic and sad American, because I can remember a time in my own life when I would say that I was proud and patriotic of this country without any other qualifier. And for me personally, that time was when I was a little boy. When I was taught that I was from the United States of America. And the United States of America was the land of the free and the home of the brave. But more importantly, I was taught that the United States of America stood for liberty and justice and equality. And I was so very proud of that. And not only that, but I was taught that the United States of America was like some great shining light on the hill, and that we were going to guarantee liberty and justice and equality for the entire world. And I was so proud to be from that country, and I'm angry because I grew up and realized I had been lied to. But I want to be clear, and that's also referring back to George Friday's earlier comments. That's a little bit of that acknowledgement that we've got to actually go through. But I want to be clear about something, folks, that I won't say that I was lied to specifically, because you see, I have a face. I have an actual name that I associate that idea with. Her name is Mrs. Armstrong. She was my fifth grade teacher. So instead of saying that Mrs. Armstrong lied to me, let's just say I was subjected to a creation myth. And the reason I want to say that is because Mrs. Armstrong did not go to bed at night saying, I can't wait till these little children come into my classroom so I can fill their mind full of lies and propaganda about how this country operates. No, of course not. She was a public teacher, and like every public teacher I've ever met, Mrs. Armstrong wanted to help nurture children to become productive members of society, to take their rightful place in that society. You see, Mrs. Armstrong taught that creation myth, and it worked on me, it worked on my classmates, and as I'm watching how you're reacting to my words, it worked on almost everybody in this room, right? Come on, admit it, right? When we are exposed to that creation myth, it works on us because we want to believe it. You see, we want to live in liberty, justice, and equality. And I'll go one step further. We deserve to live in liberty, justice, and equality. And may I say, you can applaud that. We deserve it. It's our birthright. As human beings, it's our birthright. And may I suggest that you want and deserve those things, not because you're an American, if you are. You want those things because you're a human being. Yeah. Right? And absolutely, absolutely, absolutely it is true that American children want and deserve liberty, justice, and equality. And you know what? So do Iraqi children and Afghan children and Israeli children and Palestinian children and Mexican children and children all across the world. And what I'm getting at in my presentation, what I think this peace symposium is doing, if you look at the arc of the agenda of our time this weekend, is the recognition that there is a worldwide movement. It is, in fact, a human rights movement that we're actually talking about. And we can own that. We can relish in that. We can step into that. And if we're really courageous, if we're really opening our hearts and our heads and our minds, can we imagine a movement that also celebrates rivers and streams and deer and birds and fish and the interconnectedness of life itself? That's the movement I really want to be talking about, right? A movement that intertwines ecology, democracy, peace, justice. That's the kind of movement that I think we are capable of being part of, and it's what makes me so inspired to be here with you today. Now, you know, so before I get into the substance of what I've been asked to talk about, which is corporations and the Constitution, I want to be clear and candid with you that I'm going to try to be persuasive. And because I'm going to try to be persuasive, I want to share with you something that I already knew intuitively as a trial lawyer, but now science is proving beyond a shadow of a doubt, the cognitive scientists are proving that if you really want to be persuasive, facts don't really matter that much. I mean, when you say it that way, it's sort of like, because I don't know about you, but I have spent a lot of time learning facts. Right? And here's the thing, though. It's not true to say that facts don't matter. Facts do matter. But check this out. What really matters is the stories that we tell each other. Because, see, we make sense of the world through the stories that we tell each other. That's what a narrative means. There's a cultural narrative that we understand how the world works, right? And what happens when you are presented with new facts is that you process that new fact based on your pre-existing narrative, how you already see and understand the world to work, right? So since stories are so important, I'm going to tell a story. I'm going to tell a story about how it came to be that large transnational corporations are not just exercising power today. I'm going to tell a story about how transnational corporations are ruling us. How it came to be that these unelected and unaccountable corporate CEOs are making the fundamental public policy decisions that affect all of our lives. Corporate CEOs are deciding how much poison will be in the water that we're all drinking. Corporate CEOs are deciding how much toxins will be in the air that we're all collectively breathing. Corporate CEOs decided what transportation choices you were going to have. Corporate CEOs decided what kind of health care you get, and for many of us, what kind of health care we won't get. Corporate CEOs have already determined the energy policy in this country, and them at all, corporate CEOs decided to take this country into war. Yes. And we, the people, have been relegated to choose between paper or plastic at the grocery store. We get to choose between Coke and Pepsi. We can have 17 different types of toothpastes, 31 different ice cream flavors. Let me be clear, folks, we are inundated with consumer choices, provided you have the money to pay. That's kind of an important thing to recognize and talk about in this country. But when it comes to what kind of society do we want to live in, like how will the institutions actually operate? We rarely get any opportunity to participate in any way, much less in a meaningful way, with how this country is actually going to operate. And that is a problem, right? That is a problem. So the point that I'm making is that we recognize that we have a problem now, and I am going to make sure that we get some clarity, because a word has been tossed around a lot today, and we'll be talking about it again. That word is democracy. That word is so important that I want to make sure that we've got some clarity. To make sure that we've got that clarity, here's a quick pop quiz. What language is this from?
Greek.
It's from Greek. Let's break it down. Democracy. People. Demos means?
People.
Kratia means?
Rule.
So literally the word democracy means the people rule. Follow-up pop quiz. How many folks believe we the people are ruling in the United States? Don't be shy. Look around at the Longhouse at Lane Community College today. Not a single hand went up in the air. Folks, I do this presentation all across the country. I was on the road over half my life last year and this year as well. Sometimes they would do an afternoon event and an evening event. It is rare that anybody raises their hand to that question. And that is a problem. And if you look at it a different way, I will tell you that's a good thing. It's not a good thing that we the people don't rule, but it is a good thing that nobody's raising their hand anymore. It's a good thing that we're finally being courageous enough to actually confront reality, that we're actually being willing to disabuse ourselves from that creation myth. You know, and it's a beautiful creation myth, but it's a myth, damn it. We don't have a functioning democratic republic, and it's a good thing that we're finally actually coming to terms with it. Now, with that understanding, since we don't actually have a democracy, I want to be clear about this. I want to be part of one, right? I don't want to just describe the problem endlessly or, you know, have a sort of analysis of paralysis so that I just keep talking about how bad the problem is. The reality is that we don't have a functioning democracy now, and at the same time, we have to recognize that throughout all of U.S. history, there have been moments, sustained struggles that resulted in more democracy, right? Not a completely, if not a finished process, but it is a process. That's what movements mean. Both David West and Ben Mansky and George Friday repeatedly referred to movements, right? And from my perspective, that's what they were talking about. They were recognizing and acknowledging the sustained struggle, and frankly, joyous struggle many times, but the joyous struggle that people engaged in for power. Because honestly, understood from a particular perspective, every single movement that's worth being called a movement was a struggle for power, a struggle to actually be part of and able to participate in making the decisions that affect our lives. So let's just acknowledge that what's going on in the early stages, not just in this country, but across the world, is a worldwide democracy movement. Yeah. And because I think it's important to do as a North American myself is to recognize, to have a little damn humility and recognize that for North Americans, we're kind of late to the game. Right? I mean, if you really want to see what really vibrant social movements that become democracy movements that are actually challenging for and winning power look like, you got to look to North Africa, you got to look to the Middle East, you got to look to Latin America, right? That's what it looks like. And frankly, if we would have a little more humility as Americans and North Americans, if we would actually recognize that we need to ask ourselves, what did they look at? How did they understand the world? What are they doing? That, my friends, will actually be a very valuable lesson for us. And when we do that, not only is it a humbling experience, but it's also, for me, an inspiring experience because I begin to realize, oh, it doesn't have to be like this. It doesn't have to be like this at all. It's an amazing phenomenon that actually occurs this way. So, democracy means the people rule. We don't really have it. I'm going to now make sure that we cover another idea together. And that is the word sovereignty. Now, before we define sovereignty, let me just ask this. If I just had the word the sovereign, who or what would you think of? A king. Almost all of us say that because a story. We're actually living in a society in which we understand the king is sovereign. The sovereign is king. That's because 500 years ago, the king was the sovereign. The sovereign was the king. Those words were literally synonymous. That's because the word sovereignty, properly understood, means the authority to rule. And where, by the way, do you think the king claimed his sovereignty? God. You don't get more legitimate. Right? I mean, if you really want to think about sovereignty in a real way, think about God. And to really illustrate what I mean by that, we'll do a quick little exercise together. This is always a lot of fun for me. You'll see, I will invite the Longhouse here at Lane College to please close your eyes for a moment and repeat after me. David Cobb is the king.
David Cobb.
I told y'all this was fun for me. We'll try again. Therefore, anything David says must be obeyed. One last one, because David is God's representative on earth, and we kneel before him. Okay. You know, normally I would say, now you can open your eyes, but to your credit here in Eugene, Oregon, nobody's eyes are closed. Good on you, y'all. Good on you. So, but I will make this observation that you did what every other group does whenever you realize what I'm asking you to do, and that is y'all laughed at me. Right? I mean, did you notice it was like a collective guffaw? Everybody kind of laughed at that. And I want to say, you know why you laughed at it? Because it's funny. And not, by the way, funny as in, oh, David is so witty. He's just made a very droll comment. No, it wasn't funny at that sophisticated level. It was funny as what a comedian would say is absurdist humor. I said something absurd. And so the only proper response is really to laugh at it because you can't really process that, right? And to be clear, to say that I get to say how this gentleman lives his life because of who my parents are, of course that's absurd, right? Or even better, that I get to say how all of society is going to be operating because of the divine right of kings. I mean, of course you laughed at it. That's hilarious. That's absurd. And 500 years ago, people just like you and you and you and me, human beings just like us, not only said it, but we believed it. And folks, that's because if enough people think that something is true, if enough people act like it's true,
it's true.
I really want to underscore the fact that sovereignty, who has the authority to rule, is kind of one of the most important questions that any society answers for itself. And, you know, Stan mentioned that I'm a Green Party member. I'm proud of that. But I'm equally proud to say I work very closely with progressive Democrats on issues day in and day out. I'm equally proud to tell you that I work with principled conservatives and Republicans and libertarians, especially when I do civil liberties defense work. George Friday, am I right? It's libertarians and Republicans that are often on the front line on the fights against the NDAA and the Patriot Act and so forth. I've got a history of working in coalition with Republicans. Hell, I've worked with socialists and anarchists as well, right? I have a long history of working in respectful coalition with people that I may not agree with on everything, but if I can find enough common ground, I will look for the opportunity to work in coalition. I don't say that so that you will, you know, pat me on the head. I say that so you'll really appreciate what I mean when I say, in my 25 years of social change efforts and working for a different world, I have never had the privilege or the opportunity to work in coalition with a monarchist. And 500 years ago, that's all there were. And 500 years is the blink of an eye in human history. So when people tell me that we can't amend the Constitution, that it's too hard, or it's too big, or it's too ingrained, or even better, when people say that we can't actually imagine a foreign policy that's actually based on peaceful, respectful relations with other peoples, when people tell me that we can't transition away from a corporate capitalist system that's destroying the life of planet Earth itself, when people tell me that's not possible, I think, have you not been paying attention? Real, systemic, fundamental change can be made. All it takes is enough people to think differently and enough people to act differently. And if it is true that the United States of America is a fundamentally racist, sexist, class-oppressive society, and it is, then may I suggest it's about time that we started to think and act and talk differently. We need to take ourselves seriously. We do need to take ourselves seriously because, as every one of the speakers before me pointed out, that we are in a crisis moment. We are in a crisis moment, and the crisis actually is a series of crises because there's an ecological crisis, there's an economic crisis, there is a social justice crisis. These are intersected crises that all come together. So the most important thing I think that we can do from the jump is to just tell the truth. We got to tell the truth about what it is that we're dealing with, what the circumstances are, because I think that if we do so, it will allow us to understand not only the problem, but frankly, and more importantly, it will suggest what we ought to do and how we ought to do it and what we ought to do. So, we the people are not ruling. We know that we are not sovereign, or the current situation isn't, but I think it's important to recognize that sovereignty we originally thought of as coming from the king, right? And I think that that's important to recognize because this idea of illegitimacy of the divine right of kings is something that we should be sort of taking seriously these days. The last concept that I want to make sure that we actually cover is the idea of a corporation. Since this is equally important, let me ask the same question. What language is that from? Latin. It's from Latin. Let's break this one down. Corpus means?
Body.
And now for extra credit, do I have any Latin scholars? The suffix T-I-O-N? It means the state of or the quality of. So literally the word corporation would mean to have or create body. And by body, I mean literally physical body. That's because in law school we're taught, and by the way, are there any lawyers in the crowd besides me that would admit it? There's Stan's hand. It's a friendly crowd, y'all. You won't get in trouble here. All right, so finally another hand goes up. So do y'all remember in law school being taught that a corporation is a legal fiction? Yep, I'm seeing my two brothers at the bar raise their hand. Watch this. Even if you couldn't exactly define that term, even if you weren't subjected to law school, and trust me, that is being subjected, but if you weren't subjected to law school, but if you just heard that a corporation is a legal fiction, raise your hand. Look at all those hands go up. So a corporation is a legal fiction. We understand that. A corporation is a legal fiction. So that begs the question, what does the word fiction mean?
Lie.
Not true. A lie made up. We're taught in law school that a corporation doesn't actually exist. However, we will pretend like this group of people who are doing something together, this resources that are coming together, these contractual obligations, these assumptions and so forth, this very complex kind of idea, we're going to pretend like it's one physical thing so that we can treat it a certain way under law. And of course, if enough people think that something is true, if enough people act like it's true,
it is true.
Poof! We just created a corporation. Point I'm making here, folks, is that we create a corporation as a construct. And the word corporation is from Latin because the genius of human creativity to create corporations for the first time and that would look like a corporation that we would think of were actually created during the Roman Republic. Not, by the way, during the Roman Empire. And sometimes I wish we spent more time in this country asking, what happens when a republic devolves into an empire? Because that might be an important conversation in the United States of America. Just saying. Or, as Bill Hicks, the great Texas comedian, would say, just planting seeds. Just planting seeds. But the point I'm making is that a corporation was created during the Roman Republic for a reason. A construct is created for a reason. And, for example, y'all heard the phrase, all roads lead to Rome? Yeah, here it is, 2,000 years later. We've all heard that phrase, right? Check it out. That road system was actually laid out and built as a corporation. Likewise, the aqueduct system, that amazing bit of engineering that moved water all across the Italian peninsula, actually designed by, built by, maintained as a corporation. Likewise, the first universities, the first hospitals. Can y'all guess? Corporation, corporation. Point I'm making is we're talking about a road system, a water system, a university, a hospital. What do those four things have in common?
Public.
They're a common good. They're all for the public. The genius of the idea of the construct of creating a corporation was to take private money, material, and resources and put it to common good. But there's another way that the government takes private money. What's that called?
Taxes.
And I'm not here to denigrate taxes. I mean, I think taxes are a worthy, noble thing to do. In fact, have y'all heard that Oregon is suffering from a budget crisis? Maybe some of y'all might have heard that. Here's something that I don't think that's true. I mean, there is an allocation crisis, but the reality is that Oregon, just like every state in the union, especially the United States of America nationally, there are riches beyond imagining, really. We don't have a budget crisis, we have an allocation crisis. If you actually want to solve this so-called budget crisis, it's a really simple three-word solution. If you know it, you can say it with me. Tax the rich. Problem solved. See how easy that was? So the point I'm making is, I think that taxes are an important thing, but the point I'm making is, taxes are mandatory. For example, sir, when you go to pay your taxes, has it been your lived experience that the tax person shows up and says, hey, it's tax time, would you be willing to pay, maybe? No? It's not my experience either, right? Taxes are mandatory. The difference, and I really want to be clear about this, the concept of a corporation to take private resources, money, material, put it for public use, but do it on a voluntary basis. That, in its essence, was the idea of creating the first corporations. And the point I really want to underscore here is that's a good idea. David Cobb is not anti-corporation. The Move to Amend Coalition is not anti-corporation. That's not really thinking very clearly. I'm anti-oppression, I'm anti-destruction, but the idea of a corporation is an instrument that can actually be put to good and noble things. The problem, of course, is this is not exactly how the modern transnational corporation operates, is it? That's because the modern transnational corporation actually doesn't come out of this time period, but instead out of the 15th, 16th, 17th century of Europe. You know, the age of discovery. I have to put discovery in quotation marks because I said I'd tell the truth, and it's not the age of discovery, notwithstanding the creation myth that I was told in the sanitized history textbook that I was subjected to. Because after all, what was discovered in the 15th, 16th century by Europeans? Africa, Asia, later North and South America. Newsflash, there were people living there. They weren't lost. They didn't need to be discovered. And so, in the interest not only of truth-telling, but also of being courageous enough to confront reality, which I think we need to do, let's acknowledge that the 15th and 16th century of Europe is actually the age of rape and pillage and plunder and murder. There's one word for me that underscores that. You can applaud that. We got to say it out loud. It's empire. And the point I'm making, the transnational corporation that we know today was not just accidentally created during the age of empire. The modern transnational corporation was created as an instrument of empire, intentionally and deliberately used to facilitate imperialism. Because you see, empire means beating people down. It means killing them. It means taking their things. It means taking their resources. It means taking their lives and enslaving them if that's what you decide to do. It's brutal and it's ugly, and there's no way that we can talk about it without being righteously angry about the history from which we come. Now, the reason I really want to underscore this is that one of the very early transnational corporations was a little outfit known as the East India Company, literally designed to subjugate, to destroy the people of the subcontinent of India. And not only to conquer their bodies, but, get this, to destroy all of their institutions, to destroy the stories that they had told one another, to force them to tell a new story, and to force them to go about assisting in their own oppression, assisting in the transfer of the material resources out of India and sending the profits to the shareholders of the East India Company, not only to colonize their bodies, but to colonize their minds. And may I suggest that today a big part of the problem is we in the United States of America are colonized.
Amen.
We are colonized. And may I say, I don't mean that, oh, Americans who are out there who are not part of this conference are colonized. I mean, we are colonized. I am colonized. We are subjected to this. We can't help it. It's the world in which we're living. It's the stories that we've been told. Frankly, to underscore it, another of those early joint stock companies or corporations was known as the Africa Trading Company. Would anybody like to guess what the Africa Trading Company traded? Thank you. So you know what? I'm going to use myself as an example because I think it's important to actually own this. I promise you, I give this presentation all the time. I ask that question all the time. But if I'm not really thinking clearly, if I'm sort of being just lazy and just, if I just say, what did the Africa Trading Company trade? Honestly, the word that pops into my head, unbidden to me. The word that just would pop into my head, slaves. The Africa Trading Company traded slaves. We talk about the African slave route, the African slave trade. That's the story that I've been told, right? Doesn't make me a bad person. I'm not a bad person. Actually, I'm a good person. But I'm a colonized person. It's the story that I've been told over and over again. You see, the thing is, now that I've made such a big deal about that, let's ask the question another way. Was Africa populated by slaves?
No.
Of course not. Africa was populated by?
People.
And frankly, y'all, people who were basically just like me. And I say that with full awareness of my pigment. I say that with full awareness of my skin color. I'm not stupid, but I say it with conviction and clarity, because if you ask any scientist, if you ask any biologist, she or he will tell you race does not exist. Right? Race does not exist. But check this out. Racism certainly does. How can that possibly be? Why, if enough people think that something is true, if enough people act like it's true, poof! We use race to create a construct. And there's a reason for that too, folks. And that reason is to attempt to justify slavery. But I want to be clear that I'm not saying that the corporations or that era created the idea of slavery. I'm saying it was a different justification. Because let's go back before the corporations or before the age of imperialism. We'll do another little exercise to illustrate this. And in this exercise, let's imagine that Abraham and I, this fellow right here, we are in different tribes. There is a river that separates our tribe. My tribe goes to war against Abraham's tribe, and my tribe wins this war. And
come on, don't win today.
So here's a question, y'all. Why do you think my tribe will win this war against Abraham's tribe?
Because
What are some reasons? God's on my side, an important one. Stronger.
Everybody else is barbarians. You're the only tribe that's not barbarian.
I'm the only non-barbaric tribe. All of these are good answers. I might have more people. I might have better technology and more weapons. I might just be more culturally vicious. All of those things might be good suggestions. But I haven't given you enough real information to really know why my tribe will win this hypothetical war. Shall I tell you why my tribe wins the war against Abraham's tribe? Because I'm telling the story. See how important who tells the story is? Stories matter, y'all. Unfortunately for you, Abraham, I am telling this story. So my tribe wins the war. I put my spear up against Abraham's throat, and I say, Abraham, you're now my slave. Let me ask you all something. What's the intellectual, philosophical justification for David to enslave Abraham?
You're holding it.
The spear might makes right. Another way to say it is, there's no real intellectual justification for it. Point I'm making is that slavery before the Age of Enlightenment was just power over, and there wasn't even an effort to justify it. After the Age of Enlightenment, it became necessary to somehow explain or to justify it. And as outrageous, as stupid, as profane as it is, the idea of race gets created as a construct to try to justify the absurd idea that it's okay to enslave people, and even more ridiculous, that it's okay to enslave people on the basis of pigment. And I guess what I'm getting at is that racism, militarism, imperialism, corporatism, these are all inextricably linked concepts. And what links them all at the end of the day is oppression. And another way to say that is the same way that one of the great American political orators of all time said it. And that is to say that, I'm talking about the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. And in his best political speech, not his most famous speech, but his best political speech, known as Beyond War or Beyond Vietnam, King said, the United States of America today is in a spiritual and moral decay. I mean, King was a man of faith. Remember that. He was a reverend. This is kind of heavy words for a reverend. The United States of America is in a spiritual and moral decay because of the triple evils of racism, militarism, and extreme materialism, or just greed. And King said, unless and until we confront those evils, we can never become the country that we deserve to be. The United States of America can never become the country that we want it to be. And according to King, he says, we could not become the country that God intends us to be. And folks, again, what connects extreme greed, what connects imperialism, militarism, racism, these are all different forms of the oppression. And I think that what we need to do is come to terms with the fact that a real democracy movement has got to be committed to an anti-oppression framework. We've got to commit ourselves, right? You can applaud that. We've got to commit ourselves. And I want to be clear. I will self-identify and do my best to try to be a good anti-racist white person. I will try to be the best male feminist that I can be, not so I get patted on the head. In fact, I do those things not because they're the right things to do, although they are the right things to do. I'm really committed to those because I want to win. And I don't see any way to win the world that I want unless we actually deal with those. So, you know, we talked about the king and we talked about corporations. And since I've finally gotten around to America in my little story, here's a question. How many original colonies in the United States? 13. Come on, y'all. That's a gimme. You know that. So there were 13. So here's my real question. How many of those 13 colonies were actually corporations? 13. All of them, in this sense, remember that the word corporation means to have or create body, to give body to something. I'm here to tell you that the king created those colonies. Where, again, did the king claim cultural authority? God. So that's what they were up against. To look at the king and to see behind the king the most powerful military the world had ever seen to that point and say, King, you're done. Get out. We're doing it different now. Because let me tell you something, folks, that process that I've just described, that's magic. And I want to be clear, if one person stands up against injustice and oppression and unfairness. That's beautiful. That's courageous. That deserves to be applauded. But that act alone is not magic. Because from my perspective, the magic happens if one person stands up and somebody to her left stands up and somebody to her right stands up and there's this collective standing up. See, the magic happens whenever somehow something amazing happens, an entire cultural shift happens. And at this point, may I just say, may the goddess bless the Occupy movement. Because that is magic. There is something magical going on there. They're imagining, they're daring us to think and act differently and bigger. And that, I think, is what we're up against. And so, folks, we know that the king gets thrown out. And we know that a new charter gets written. A new instrument comes into play. And what is this new instrument, the supreme law of the land? The U.S. Constitution. How many people here have read the U.S. Constitution? Y'all be honest. Look at all those hands go up. So very quickly, folks, I am going to lay out my understanding of how the U.S. Constitution is supposed to operate. When you look at it, and not just read the words, but as my mama would say, step back from the tapestry, son. Read the words, but look at the pattern. Look at what it actually is trying to tell you, how it's supposed to operate. And I will tell you, when you look at that, you'll see two actors. The first actor is the most important actor. In fact, it's so important, it's the first three words. All I have to do is put my hand to my ear and folks say that in unison, we the people. That's because these are hallowed words in this country, and they should be. You see, we the people come together to create the second actor, which is government. Let's just note that we the people create government. Government does not pre-exist us. In fact, government is dependent upon us. Another way to say it is, in this framework, we the people are free and sovereign. And what does the word sovereign mean again? The authority to rule. We're claiming the authority to rule. The king is not sovereign. We kick the king out. But check this out. Government isn't sovereign either. In fact, to the contrary, government is subordinate and accountable. Government is subordinate to whom? The people. Government is accountable to whom? The people. That's got a ring to it, doesn't it? I like how this is going. Let's continue. We the people are free and sovereign because we the people have rights. Government never has rights. Government only has duties. And let me stop for a moment and underscore, if I've got the right to do something, it means I can do it and I don't need anybody's permission. I don't need the city of Eugene's permission. I don't need the state of Oregon's permission. I don't need the federal government's permission. Look, I'm from Texas, y'all. I don't need my mama's permission. If I have the right to do something, it means I can just do it. And if government tries to infringe upon my rights, government's wrong, not me. That's important. And government never has rights over the people. Government only has duties. And if you have a duty, it means you have to do something. And where do those government duties come from? Well, remember this. All power resides with the people. In fact, that's another magical phrase. To really illustrate that very quickly, let's just do something very quick. I'll ask you, you don't have to do this, but if you're willing to, let's just try it out. I'm going to say four words. I'll say power to the people, and you say
power to the people.
Let's try it again. I'm going to say power to the people.
Power to the people.
One more time. Power to the people.
Power to the people.
Now look around at each other. Honestly, almost all of you are smiling right now. And you know what? I think it's because we recognize that saying those words out loud together is magic, and it makes us think about that. That is beautiful. And quick pop quiz, what is the population more or less of Eugene, Oregon?
157,000.
157,000 more or less? Well, I will celebrate that 150,000 folks in Eugene have all the political power. That's wonderful. That's amazing. But I'll tell you this. I don't want to go to the meeting of 157,000 people where we decide where to put stop signs. And I like political meetings. I'm not going to that one. Anybody up to facilitating that particular meeting? Point I'm making is, folks, yes, we the people have all the political power, but we wisely delegate a certain amount of our power to government. Certainly not all of our power to government. In fact, all The only power we delegate to government is enough for government to perform the duties that they have. And how does government discharge their duties? By writing laws at the local, state, or federal level. That's what legislation is. Properly understood, that's what it is. Now, here's the thing. Today, to create a corporation, all you need to do is file some paperwork, submit it to the Secretary of State, send them some money, and they will issue you that same charter. That charter will last forever. That charter, you can do, quote, all lawful things according to Oregon law right now. And in the first 75 years of this country, to create a corporation, you had to go to the state government and get approval and permission. You had to identify a public need that was not being met by existing government. And, by the way, you also were only given a charter for a limited time period and only to do the limited thing that you were asked to do. And if you ever did anything other than what you were asked to do, or if you ever acted outside the public interest, do you know what happened to your corporate charter? Revoked. Corporate charters were routinely revoked. So, I'm not saying this is the land of milk and honey. What I'm saying is that we know for a fact that at that time that corporations were properly controlled. So here's the bottom line, folks. Since we know that it takes an action of state government to create the corporation, we know that the corporate charter can be used to hold the corporation subordinate and accountable. We know that the duties of a corporation are described by the charter. Isn't it obvious that a corporation should be properly under the control of we the people? And here's the bottom line, folks. When the U.S. Supreme Court, in an act of supreme judicial activism, says, oh no, we're going to simply say that a corporation is like a person with rights, it perverts this whole framework. Because, folks, that's the end of the day. Corporate personhood or corporations having constitutional rights is not just illogical, which it is. Corporate constitutional rights or corporate personhood is not just stupid, which it is. Corporate constitutional rights is a linchpin for how the ruling elite have hijacked our government from us. They have hijacked our society from us. And what angers me, as a lawyer especially, is that they use our legal system to justify it and tell us that it's legal what they've done and that all we're allowed to do is argue at the margins, but we don't have the authority to actually decide whether or not or how we're going to best protect our elections or how we're going to protect our watershed or how we're going to do it, and that we have to let the corporations do it. Well, I say, ya basta, enough already. It's time for a movement that takes itself seriously. That movement, I believe, is best represented by Move to Amend. Amend what? Our Constitution. It's our Constitution. Yeah. And to close it off, our demands, and as my colleague George Friday says, our initial demands, abolish the idea that a corporation is a person with constitutional rights, and abolish the idea that money equals speech. These two together have been, I believe, how it is that over time we have lost control and even many of us lost the ability to articulate the world that we know in our hearts that we want. We carry it in our hearts, we've got ideas of it in our head, but how many of us actually have committed ourselves to helping to create that world? And what I'm telling you is, if we join the democracy movement that I talked about earlier, that's what it's going to look like. Peace. All right. So, oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks. So, here's a question. If we are going to all of the trouble of amending the Constitution, why don't we call for a constitutional convention and fix the whole flawed things? It's just as hard. The short answer is, I agree with that with this quick caveat. Let's recognize that whether it's a constitutional convention or going through the Congress, either one of those are a political question, right? And amendment can be either constitution or congressional proposal. But the point is that that's a Y in the road, and that Y in the road, you don't get to that Y until you've covered a lot of political ground to begin with. So I'm willing to entertain which one is better or the next, but the point that I'm making is that we've got to actually travel that road. We've got to undo a lot that's gone on. And to show about just a little sense of to undo what we're talking about, I'm going to take this opportunity to unravel for you very quickly. Can we do? How quickly can we move this? This, by the way, is from our colleagues at the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, a timeline that shows the single cases, one by one by one, of what it looks like when corporations gain or lose constitutional rights. Absolutely, we've got to actually be willing to deal with all of these things, but at the end of the day, it's not a legal question, it's a political question. We've got to do the political organizing, because lastly, before I don't want a convention tomorrow. You know why? We haven't done our work yet. We haven't organized and educated enough. We haven't actually created an anti-racist movement. We haven't created a peace movement. We haven't created the movements that are going to be strong enough to withstand the corporate media and the right wing that are going to actually try to come in and take that over. Bottom line, I don't think we're ready yet. Thank you. Thanks. So the next question is, can I talk about the success of Move to Mend locally and nationally? Look, it's amazing. I've never been part of anything that has moved this fast and been this successful. We didn't even exist before 2010. Today, we have over 200,000 people actively participating. We have several hundred local affiliates. I hope many of you will be part of local Move to Mend affiliates in your own community. We have And we have won resolutions, not only from city council, but won elections that are actually part of the, in Boulder and Missoula and Denver. We won in conservative West Allis, Wisconsin, by putting it on the ballot. So we have a grassroots organizing strategy, working our way from the bottom up, and we definitely are committed to that. Thank you so much for coming out. Thank you for being here. We'll be right back.